Because I am an innocent man.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. I'm going to give the phone number out here if you have any comments for any of our guests. Give us a call, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number, 312-981-7200. At 8 o'clock, we're going to be taking your calls, so any calls you have about legal issues, breach of contract, small claims, family law, I'm happy to help you through your problems or try to direct you to the right place. If for some reason you can't get through to me or you want to talk to me more privately, I'm always happy to talk to you at my office and try to give you some direction. The number at my office is 312-332-7800, or better yet, send me an email at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Our next guest is Josh Tepfer, who's been representing the criminally accused for decades. He was first an appellate defender and then a professor and director at the Northwestern University Center on Wrongful Convictions. He's now with the civil law firm of Lovey & Lovey, which is the country's most successful civil rights firm with over $100 million of settlements and judgment for the wrongfully convicted and people who are victims of police misconduct. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Now, you are dedicated to the issue of wrongful convictions. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And tell me, let's just talk about a couple of cases, and then I want to hear a little bit about how wrongful convictions happen. We hear about it, we watch it on television, but I want to get your read because you're right there on the ground actually litigating these cases. Let's talk about the Marquette Four, which reared its head this last week. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this case?
Sure. The Marquette Park Four is an example of what we call a multi-defendant wrongful conviction. So this is a case from back in 1995 where four children, four teenagers aged 15 to 19, were accused and interrogated and coerced into confessing to a double murder on a Southside auto lot. And those confessions sealed their fate. Now, it wasn't a trial, wasn't anything. It was a day after that this crime occurred, these four kids being brought to the station and browbeaten into a confession. And that locked them up, sealed their fate for about 22 years. I worked on the case for about 8 years. We got some post-conviction forensic testing, some fingerprints and palm prints from the crime scene, from multiple cars from the crime scene, and then a sticker from a stolen car from the crime scene, like a marketing sticker. And all of those fingerprints didn't point to the four kids who had confessed, but it pointed to a different 16-year-old boy who had nothing to do with any of these guys and who was part of a gang family, and that led ultimately to their exoneration.
Why wasn't the fingerprinting done right when they were convicted?
There was some fingerprint that was done when they were convicted, and it excluded them. The technology, like DNA, like some other technology, has improved through the years, so we were able to do some new fingerprint testing and put it in what's called the APHIS database. So there's this DNA database of called CODIS, and there's also a fingerprint database, and that matched to this convicted felon in multiple spots. What we also learned is that fingerprints from the sticker were sort of hidden from the public view for a long time and hidden from the defense attorneys and the defendants themselves. So that was a real big problem as well.
Is that a problem in a lot of these wrongful conviction cases where there's withholding of evidence that might exonerate the defendants?
Sure. I mean, wrongful convictions, you know, happen for all sorts of reasons. They happen because of mistake. They happen because people like you and me and human error, and people lie. People have their flaws. But what I've come to realize, especially over the last half decade of doing this, is lots of times wrongful convictions are no mistake, and they happen from misconduct, whether it's prosecutors, whether it's, and far too often in this city, from police misconduct, hiding of evidence, coercing confessions, and going back to the Marquette Park Four. I mean, one of the reasons we know that these were intentionally fabricated confessions is because these four kids all had interlocking confessions. They all blamed each other or blamed themselves altogether. Now we know all that was made up, and there's only one explanation for how that happened. That's the police fed that.
So many questions. Let's go to the issue of their age. Now, these were kids, okay? They're in the wrong place at the wrong time, apparently, and they, what right does a minor have to have an adult present while there is a police interrogation?
You know, let's back up. They weren't in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were picked up and grabbed into African-American youth, and, you know, the what Illinois allows, and all states are different, is, you know, some sort of attempt to contact the parent. But if you are, police are, don't make, need to make much of an attempt, and they don't, there's no requirement they, that they're there. Really, all it is this, what they call this very vague totality of the circumstances test. Is your will overborne? Is it voluntary? But the problem, what was going on for so many, for so, so long, is it was under this veil of secrecy, right? I mean, here we are. We're out in the open right here. Everyone can watch us.
Michigan Avenue.
Michigan,
that's right,
Avenue.
Yeah.
People are waving to us as we go. Everything's out in the open now. But in the most important part of any criminal case, which is your interactions with the police, it's this veil of secrecy. They're not recording it. No one knows what happens. And for decades and decades, it would be these kids, these black kids or Hispanic kids, that versus these esteemed police who say, and they told one story of what happened, that they were browbeaten, that they were told what to say, that they were threatened with the death penalty, that they were physically abused, that they were tortured. We saw that versus the police saying, nope, I followed the FOP, I followed the rule book to the T. And over again, judges and prosecutors and even defense attorneys for years and years just believed the police over the kids. And we're starting to see a little sea change of that now.
Now, these kids, I just have to get the fact out. You said they, I said the wrong place, right, you know, wrong time. They weren't. They just picked these people up, and how did they come to conclude that they did it?
You know, there's always a question in this case. In this case, all we know is that there is a unknown confidential informant who told the police that one of the four defendants, a guy named Troshon McCoy, a 17-year-old kid in the Marquette Park 4 case, had some information about it. I've litigated this case for a decade. To this day, I still do not know who that unnamed confidential informant is.
And you don't have a right to know that as a criminal defense or a person who spends 20 years in jail.
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the other reasons that we have these wrongful convictions, whether they're intentionally brought, some of these prosecutions, knowing that the kids didn't do it, or they're truly mistakes. That's something I want to talk to you about. We're talking to Josh Tepfer with Lovey and Lovey, and it's the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Josh Tepfer and with the Exoneration Project, and we're talking about wrongful convictions, and there's so many of them over the last 20 years that it's just hard to even name them. Here's my question to you. I know that people make mistakes, and there's going to be wrongful convictions, and there have been since time began, but do you see, what does a prosecutor or the police officers, do they think somebody's guilty and then they maybe stoke it and maybe find some evidence that wasn't there in order to convict the person? Or do they know right from the beginning, generally, that this person didn't do it, but they just have to put this crime to bed?
Both. I mean, there's tunnel vision. There's exactly the scenario that you get, and there's well-meaning police officers and prosecutors who make mistakes. But what you've seen so routinely in this city in particular, and really throughout the country, is just the routine, intentional fabrication of evidence. And perhaps the best example, and what I've dedicated sort of the last couple of years of my life working on, is this situation that went on throughout the 2000s in the Ida B. Wells housing projects. And that was really what we know now was, for a decade, this Sergeant Ronald Watts, who's now a convicted felon, and a team of his officers were just running roughshod over this community. They were basically running their own drug line. They were doing it, and anyone who wouldn't cooperate with them or anyone who would seek to expose them, they would retaliate against. And what we saw is, so far, what we've uncovered over the last 2 years is roughly 30 overturned convictions. 30 times where we have now had a judge and the prosecutors in Cook County say, these officers framed these individuals, just intentionally made up a drug crime. And that's extraordinary. And really what we're looking at is it could be upwards of somewhere in the area of 500 cases. Wow. That we're looking at. And what I've been doing, what my colleagues have been doing at the Exoneration Project is going back and reexamining all of those. And one of the nice things, one of the good parts of this story is we now have a prosecutor's office, Cook County State's attorney, who is assisting in that endeavor. And we're working cooperatively to help uncover this. And what we saw in November was the first mass exoneration in Cook County history. And that was when 18 convictions were overturned. Were overturned of 15 men, all based on this Watts scandal.
Amazing. If you have any questions or comments, 312-981-7200. We have Mary wants to know, if a person is deemed to be actually innocent, exonerated, what is the compensation for them? Is there some automatic compensation? I think we all know that you can then file a civil lawsuit to try to say that this was a wrongful conviction. Those are hard cases to bring. They're hard cases to prove. But your law firm has done a really good job in those cases throughout the history of the firm. What is a person entitled to from the state?
Sure. Well, there's a process. If you become exonerated, your charges are dismissed, where you can seek a certificate of innocence. And actually, we were in court last week for those 15 men, like I told you, where 9 of them were granted a certificate of innocence. And the burden is to show not just that your conviction was overturned, but by that it's more likely than not, by the preponderance of the evidence, that you're actually innocent of that crime. And if you are found actually innocent, so it's a new proceeding, then you're entitled to some amount of statutory compensation. It depends on how long you've been in prison, but it's anywhere from roughly $85,000-$90,000 to about $215,000. So if you go away for 30 years, you get about $215,000. If you go away for 5 years, you might get $85,000. And there's all sorts of complications with that, too. As you might have heard, our state doesn't always pass a budget on time.
Right.
And so we had people waiting for 3 years who had been certified innocent to get these checks that were due to them and, you know, didn't come.
And, you know, again, I think there are some people out there who say, oh, you know, why should we care about it? You know, the system is always going to have its faults. I my opinion is that we have had more than our share in this city, and it's costing our city hundreds of thousands of dollars. I looked at a stat that said that over the last 14 years, the city of Chicago alone has paid about $642 million to for wrongful convictions and these types of things relating to John Burge, the commander who was torturing victims and these types of things. So this is actually costing the taxpayers a lot of money, number one. And number two, there are people who actually committed these crimes who walked free and probably are perpetrating crimes again. So I think we should all really make a point of paying attention to this stuff to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I admire you for being what you call yourself as a reformer. You know, you are hoping that by defending these people and bringing these issues to light, that you're going to change the system. And that's what I want to talk to you, the last thing I want to talk to you about is, you mentioned that this prosecutor, Kim Fox, is being a little bit more helpful and a little bit more receptive to the idea that there's wrongful convictions. I see this all the time all over the country. There's clear evidence that a defendant spent time in jail, didn't do the crime, and yet the prosecutor will not relinquish, you know, and will not say the person's actually innocent and will fight it. Why? Why do you think that happens from a standpoint of a prosecutor?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's really hard to admit you're wrong. And
I do it all the time, except with my husband. I do it all the time.
I'm big into saying sorry. I say sorry a lot. But I think there's a instinct to hard to say you're wrong, and hard to say I'm sorry. And I think the biggest systemic problem is the prosecutors around the country are so tied to the police. And like we've discussed a lot of this, a lot of times this is no mistake. A lot of times this is intentional misconduct or police misconduct. And so when you have prosecution offices that need their police, they need them every day in court, they need them to go there, they need them to testify, to build their cases. In every case, I've been a criminal defense lawyer, or doing criminal defense for 15 years, I've never seen a case where a police officer didn't testify. It just always happens. And so they need them every single day. And when you have those same police officers that you need, and then you're turning around and saying you got it wrong, and they don't think they got it wrong, or they know they cheated, you know, that's a tough thing for a prosecutor to overcome.
But now we have more transparency. I think we all agree that when we have the Laquan McDonald shooting on a national television, and we know that maybe things weren't brought out when they should have been brought out for whatever reason, without pointing fingers, but I think people get angry, and now they look at the prosecutors a little bit more critically, don't you think? And say, well, what are you doing about this? And why are you, you know, why are we doing what we're doing?
Well, I think there's not the knee-jerk reaction to assuming the police are always telling the truth at this point. And so I think there is, at least in this city especially, there's a, you know, a level that we've seen the DOJ being here with the Laquan McDonald, with some of this Watch stuff, where the police are starting to be held accountable. And you know, I have friends on the police force. I hope
so. Do I?
Are listening.
And they're the most wonderful, heroic people I know.
And the ones who do it well, they are as burdened by this,
of course,
of this police misconduct than anyone. It affects them. The distrust by the community that
makes it dangerous for them to do their job. How about that?
Absolutely, not dangerous and more annoying because everyone's recording them all the time.
Right.
And it just makes it more difficult. And so, I mean, it's cleaning up misconduct, cleaning up police misconduct, which has just been woefully inadequate in this city for ever, it should be a top priority because it benefits everybody.
Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Josh Tepfer, who with Lovey and Lovey and the Exoneration Project. If anyone wants to reach you, how would they reach you, Josh?
Sure. You can just reach me at jtepfer@uchicago.edu.